This is an ABC podcast.
Grant Edwards was once the strongest man in Australia. He won the title 4 years in a row by pulling planes, trucks, trains and ships. The 2001 Guinness Book of Records makes special mention of Grant's feat of single-handedly pulling a 201-ton steam engine more than 36 metres along a railway track in the country town of Thirlmere in New South Wales. Grant has also spent 3 decades with the Australian Federal Police, where he established cybercrime units to fight child exploitation and human trafficking. He also served with the AFP in East Timor and Afghanistan. Grant once heard another police officer say that when you join the force, it's like you get a backpack. Every day you go to work, you add a little pebble. Year after year, as the backpack gets heavier and heavier. Until after 30 years, it's so heavy and you're so exhausted, you can hardly move. That's what happened to Grant. His memoir is The Strong Man. Welcome to Conversations.
Thank you very much.
When did you first see strong men do their thing, Grant?
It would have been back in the late 1970s on what was then the old Wide World of Sports on Channel 9. I used to watch that religiously and thought, wow, I'd like to give that a go one day, never thinking I would.
What sort of stuff do you remember watching?
Oh, lifting the big boulders, bending iron rods over their head, tearing telephone books, just these amazing feats of strength, which as a teenager you look at and go, wow, how do they do that?
Who were the big stars back then?
People like John Paul Sigmarsson, who was 4-time World Strongest Man, Bill Kazmaier, Jeff Capes, who was up until only recently was still the Commonwealth record holder in the shot put. All these iconic men, Lou Ferrigno, who was the Hulk on TV, all those folks.
So how did you first get involved then in the strongman game?
Well, it was by accident. I'd moved to Canberra with work and I started training at the ANU, the Australian National University Gym, and I bumped into an old colleague of mine that I used to throw against, athletics throwing against, David Huxley, and he just said to me one weekend, oh, look, we've got an opening. I do this strongman event at Westfields. I need an extra body. Would you be interested? And that's how it started. It blossomed from there.
And what was the first strongman event then that you took part in on that weekend?
It was actually going down to Bundanoon to do what was called the Stones of Strength, which are quite an iconic event.
What are the Stones of Strength?
So they're round stones, sandstones, and they back in those days they ranged from about 110 to 150 kilos and they were 5 metres apart. You'd have to run, pick them up, put them on top of an old whiskey barrel.
How did that go, your first ever event lifting stones at that weight?
It went really well because they put me in first and I'd never done it before. And I had all these former World's Strongest Men from all over the world there. And I remember going, wow, if I can just get one up, I'll be happy. I got 4, but then couldn't walk for 24 hours after because my back and my legs were sore. Because the weight itself wasn't difficult, but it was the spherical shape of the stones that made it hard to lift.
How long then until you did your next event after that?
The next day, we had to go into Darling Harbour and do an event there. And I did it again with the help of a lot of painkillers and anti-inflammatories to get myself going. So,
and you weren't thinking at that point, oh, this is not a smart thing to do for your body if I'm having to dose myself up on painkillers and...
No, I was sort of reasonably young at the time with exuberance and I thought, hey, this is kind of good because you actually got people in the crowd that are cheering you on and kind of looking at you thinking, wow, what a really odd thing to do.
You'd done a lot of other sports, other kinds of athletics. Why did this one grab your devotion, do you think? What did you love about it?
I just liked the fact that these people were big human beings and they were big human beings who were strong. And I guess, you know, when you look back over time, there's always been an element of that throughout sort of history, in particular in sort of the Northern Hemisphere in Europe.
Once you threw yourself into strongman training, Grant, how much did you have to eat?
Well, I was eating about every 90 minutes from sunup to, or beyond sunup to sundown. And I'd actually set my watch to consume the calories that I needed to consume.
What would you be eating?
Oh, well, everything. Weet-Bix in the morning, toast, chicken, steak, vegetables, and the dreaded creamed rice, which was the filler in between meals and a very, very rich and dense item that I really don't ever want to see again.
You know, you must have had to spend a lot of time in the bathroom as well if you're eating that amount of food.
Correct.
Frightened to ask.
Arnold Schwarzenegger once said, remember, whatever goes in has to come out. So we'll leave it at that. We'll let the imagination go.
A lot of creamed rice. So how big did you get eating every 90 minutes?
Well, the bathroom scales only go to a certain level, so I'd have to weigh myself either at the post office or where I was. So I think I was about 162 kilos on one day, but I don't know whether that was as big as I got because I didn't have the scales to measure me.
Did people on the street start treating you differently once you gained that kind of size?
Yes, they did. I'd often get asked if I played football, either American football or Australian football, or people would say to you, what do you do? And I'd sort of say strongman, and some would confuse it with Ironman, and they say, come on, you know, you could never run that far. And I said, no, you got to. In those days, it wasn't as widely recognised.
Do strongmen always have to be huge? Is that essential?
No, they don't. In fact, Magnus Vermagnussen, who I had the fortune to compete with, he was 4 times world's strongest man. He was one of the smallest competitors on the circuit, but he was unbelievably strong and powerful, but he also had a very unique way of addressing events in terms of working through the physics of how best to move and implement. I learned a lot from him about how to look at an object and the best, most efficient and effective way to move something.
You were gaining weight with all that creamed rice and the roast chickens, but were drugs a big part of the scene?
They were, yes. In Australia, we were sponsored in those days by a company.
Yeah, you can say that, by Weet-Bix.
Yep, by Weet-Bix, yep. And as part of the agreement, we all had to be drug tested. But certainly when you went overseas and competed, and when I competed in World's Strongest Man, it was widely known that the only testing that they had for you there were for recreational drugs, not for performance-enhancing drugs.
So did people try to push that on you?
They didn't necessarily push it on me, but they said that if I took them, it'd be frightening to see what size I got. I was also being tested at work as well, so not that I would take them anyway, but it was certainly a big part of, and still is a big part of that circuit. People don't get the size they are without that level of enhancement.
What feats did the BBC come over and film you performing?
That was for their Record Breaker show. It was a 25th anniversary. And they went around the world trying to undertake as many world records as possible. And they came to Australia and partnered up with us, the Tartan Warriors, we were called.
Did you wear a kilt while you're doing all of this?
Some I did, yes. And I always got asked what was under the kilt, but I won't respond in this program. But yes, we did. So they undertook a series of events. And I was fortunate enough to be a part of that. And that's where I was able to break the world record on the train in 1996.
Well, tell me about this train. How big was it?
It was 201 tonnes, so it consisted of the engine, the actual engine, and it had a coal truck and a water truck behind it.
What was going through your mind, Grant, when you stood in front of something that big thinking, I'm supposed to pull it?
Yeah, my thoughts were, no way. There's no way in the wide world that, you know, that we could pull that. And again, I drew the short straw and went first. Magnus was actually there. He didn't compete in that event, but he gave me a piece of advice which I use and I still talk about today. And he said, you know, you have to caress the train like a lover. Be very kind and gentle and don't try and muscle it. So I very much learnt from him how to approach those.
What does that mean in practice? How do you caress a 201-tonne steam train?
Well, you give it respect, but you also understand that to get something that big moving, you've got to start slow. So the idea is once you get it moving, is to be really, really slow and methodical with your footsteps. Because if you try and move it and muscle it, as they say, you tend to jerk around and you lose your impetus. So I took very, very small steps, and patience was the hardest thing, because you know you got adrenaline coursing through your body, and all you wanted to do was just move it as quick as you could, but you had to hold yourself back. Well, I deliberately held myself
back. It's like tantric strongman.
Yes.
So how did it go?
Well, I ended up doing it twice that day, and that's not widely known, because what had happened, it was during the school holidays down in Thirlmere, so the BBC had asked to have a whole bunch of children come in to do support, and they were told that if the existing world record was 14 metres, so they said, if anyone gets over 14 metres, put your hands up and really cheer. The engineer who was driving the train was quite anxious, because he said, I can't see you over the front of the engine. So he said, if you slip, I won't know. So he briefed us before we did it. He was quite anxious. So I thought, that's fine. So I harnessed up and got ready and, you know, did what I did, and it started to move. And I thought, well, that's okay. I'm moving it, and it's moving. And I saw the line of 14 metres, and I saw it disappear under me, and I thought, oh, wow, I've got this. And then it came to a shuddering halt, and people were, you know, BBC were there, come on, pull. And I was pulling to just about blew a valve. And then the engineer came down and said, stop, 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 stop. He said, I've put the brake on.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm like, why? He goes, well, I saw the kids put their hands up. So they put both their arms up. And that in railway speak means stop. So he panicked and thought something had happened, and they were telling him to stop.
So you were pulling against the weight of the brake.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't moving it. It had absolutely stopped. I thought maybe there'd been a pebble or a coin or something put on the track where it's jammed against the wheel. So I said, well, wow, what happens now? Because there are other competitors that were going after me. So there was an agreement that if I got the other competitors to agree to allow me to have another go, I would, and I did. I got to go again at the end about an hour later after the others had had a go at it.
Told everyone to get their arms down.
I didn't tell him anything. No, I didn't tell him anything. Yes, no, please don't do that.
So what happened with that attempt?
Well, I guess it was fortunate because I had the opportunity, if you like, to do a test, and I knew that I could do it. So I knew that my sole purpose was to get as much speed as I could, which I did. And Guinness allowed us to put some, we were able to clear the slag out between the tracks and put some plywood down. So everyone wore running spikes, which helped to get a grip. So I just thought, well, I'll do this until as far as I can go. And I remember going over the 14, going over other marks that people had done, and then going off the ply that they laid. They laid about 36 metres or 30 metres of ply, thinking that no one would go beyond 30 metres. And then I started to go off that, and I felt like I could have kept going, but unfortunately, by that stage, the tracks had sort of started to elevate to go over a level crossing. So we stopped at 36.
As far as you could go.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible. If you're being filmed by the BBC and other, you know, news channels here in Australia, you must have got well known. Were you recognised and stuff on the street?
A little bit, yeah. And I did some media afterwards, and in particular in Canberra. Canberra is quite a small place, so it kind of, I guess, started to define me. I say to people, I was never defined as a police officer, or if I was, it was always, oh, you know, that cop, the strong guy that can pull things. So I was forever defined as the guy that could pull these, you know, weird implements.
You found yourself on Hey Hey Saturday a bit.
I did, yes.
What was that like?
It was actually great. I mean, who would ever thought that, you know, a couple of guys would get onto Hey Hey Saturday, and we had the fortune to be able to carry Daryl in on a Roman chair.
He was surely much lighter than a steam locomotive.
Yeah, he was, yes. And we also did pluck a duck.
I could probably carry Daryl Summers. You did pluck a duck.
We did pluck a duck, yes. So it was a great experience. Got to meet everyone. And again, you know, people, the question would always come, why do you do this?
And?
Well, because I can. That was really my only response, and I enjoyed it.
After these years, Grant, of pulling things and lifting things, what kind of shape was your body in?
Oh, not so good, yeah. I'm paying for it now. So recently had one hip operation. I've got another. I've torn my Achilles, ruptured a pectoral muscle. I've had four herniated discs in my back. But, you know, I mean, what else are you going to do?
How proud was your dad of your strongman titles and achievements?
Yeah, he was. He was hugely proud. He would never necessarily sort of say that to me, but I know I'd always get phone calls from him saying, look, I've just spoken to the local newspaper and they want to do a story on you, and can you send me a photo? And of course, I couldn't send anything digitally because he had no idea. So I had to put it in the post and send it up, and then he'd take it on. So he was very proud.
How did your mum and dad meet?
They met back in the late 50s. They were both working at a store back then, Lowe's, not the Lowe's as it is today. It was a different Lowe's. It was more of a fashion chain. So they both worked there back in the late 50s, and that's where they met.
And was your dad seen as a bit of a catch?
Oh, he was, yes. I mean, he could dance and dance very well, something that I never got from him. And he was always well-presented, dressed well, you know, always smelt well. He was considered a bit of a catch.
What happened in your family, Grant, when you were 9?
Basically, my dad had disclosed to us that he was gay, and he struggled with that. But that
fractured
our family.
Because this is what, late 1970s?
No, it would have been in the 60s by then. Yeah, it would have been late 60s. So that was, you know, as a 8-9-year-old, it was something that wasn't ever discussed. He tried to tell me what it was very awkward. And I remember saying to him, look, I know, Dad, it's all right. And he's like, you know? And I went, yeah. He goes, oh, okay, all right. And then we changed subjects. I just didn't want to put him through the, you know, the issue. I could see he was struggling to try and tell me.
Did you know anyone else, any grown up who was out, who was gay?
No, didn't know about it. I would only mostly hear, you know, from the comments that my mother would make later on in life, because she was deeply affected by that. And the fact that it split our family. And in those days, from my recollection and my sister's recollection at school, we were the only kids that come from a broken family. It didn't occur.
So he left and lived as an openly gay man.
Yes.
It's incredible courage.
Oh, absolutely.
That age,
yeah.
In that era.
It was, and he struggled because it was. He was always told it was a mental issue, and he tried to, in his mind, to do his best to be cured, not for anything other than for my sister and I. And he put himself through some horrible treatments to try and do that, which of course now we know
some of that conversion therapy.
Yes,
sort of
the Chelmsford process where they where he put himself in hospital and they put the probes into his brain and electric shocked him. He spent two periods in what was called a mental asylum back then. Put himself in there to try and overcome this, and he struggled with that for a lot in the 70s and early 80s. Yeah.
Did you tell anyone at school what was happening at home?
No. No, we didn't, both myself and my sister. It was kind of like the family secret because, one, at that age, we really didn't know too much about it, but we did know that there was a stigma involved with it, so it was best just left untouched. But, of course, people would make their own minds up as to why our family split, but we just never entered into the discussion of it.
Were you angry at him?
Initially, I was, because I didn't know, and when you don't have information, you kind of come up with your own thoughts and thoughts like, well, are we not good enough? Why did he do what he did? And there was anger. Certainly later on when things had calmed down and we had the traditional custody situation where we'd have to go to his place and things, and I didn't like going there because we didn't have a lot in common, really. I mean, he was a great cook. He made his career out of cooking. My sister used to do ballroom dancing, so they'd go and do that, and I'm like, wow, I just wanted to go play football or hang with my mates. But it was not for the want of trying. I mean, he took me out fishing once, and it was disastrous because I ended up in hospital because he hooked me with a hook in the back of the neck and things like that. So it was he tried his best, but he was never brought up in that, so he didn't know, he didn't understand.
What were things like at your mum's place where you spent most of your time after your family split up?
It became quite hard. She was very much distraught at the fact that had happened. I mean, she really thought that she had the catch of a lifetime, and to all intents and purposes, it looked like that for the first few years. But she struggled, and then at the age of 28, she used alcohol as a way to cope with it. And that led her down a pathway, unfortunately, spiralling out of control.
What were things like at home? Did friends of hers come over? Were there other boyfriends on the scene after your dad left?
There were numerous men that sort of came in and out of our lives, and they clearly, deliberately were the complete antithesis of my father. They were usually, gruff guys. Some were violent. Some were, they were big drinkers. And that very sort of typical masculine male that was, seen back in the 70s.
What about drug use? Did you see people using drugs around you too?
Yeah. When we'd gotten a little bit older, around sort of the mid-teens, one thing that my mum was very good at, and, I try not to paint a terrible picture, because when she was sober, she's a very loving, caring, kind person, and she was always there to help people, and she'd often put people before herself. And she would. We had people coming and living with us that were troubled youth. Part of that was also to help us pay the rent because we moved multiple places when I was younger, and she was working two jobs. It was hard for her to make the money that she needed. But unfortunately, some of those people that come and stayed with us or visited our house were probably not the right kind of people. For those that are old enough and remember the Sharpie groups back in the 70s, we lived at that time around sort of the western suburbs around Revesby, and a few of those folks would come over and as a young guy, watching them take drugs, shoot up heroin and things like that, it was quite confronting to see the impact and the effect that had on these people that were doing that.
When you were a kid, Grant, was there any adult in your life who offered a bit of a refuge from all of this drama that was happening with your mum and your dad?
No, not really. Only early on in the piece, it was my grandfather. And when I say early on in the piece, those sort of 8, 9, 10 years.
What sort of relationship did you have with him?
I was like his mini-me, I was told. I was a bit like the limpet attached to him. Wherever he'd go, I'd go.
Where would you go together?
I'd skip school and go with him. He used to drive a truck for a tobacco company and go into Darling Harbour, and I'd skip school. My mum would go to work, and it was up to my grandfather or grandmother to get us off to school, and he was always easy to, like most grandfathers are, you could manipulate him, and I'd go with him in the truck for the day, or we'd... I used to go and I learned to play drums at the Police Citizens Youth Club in Woolloomooloo because my uncle used to be the second in charge there. So we'd toddle off every Friday night and go in there, and I'd go and play the drums, and he'd get down to the pub with mates, and then I think I was the responsible adult getting him home on the train.
But it was a close, affectionate relationship.
It was very close, yeah. He taught me how to ride a bike, mow lawns, you know, hammer nails, drill, all those kind of things.
Sounds like a bit of the opposite to your dad.
Very much, yeah.
What happened with your granddad?
Unfortunately, when I was about 10 years old, he'd suffered a stroke, and he was in a hospital. One thing, my grandfather was a very proud man, and he always used to say, you know, if I ever become a liability on people, please do something. I don't want to ever become a liability. He was actually the age I am now, and he had that stroke, and he ended up dying by suicide while he was in hospital.
How did you find out?
I found out through my grandmother and my mother, who basically told me that, you know, Pa won't be coming home. And I didn't quite understand that, because for me also, not coming home meant, were they separating or what had happened? And I tried to question them, and they said, look, unfortunately, Pa died. And again, I couldn't understand that. I didn't sort of comprehend it. And even when they, you know, they had the traditional wake and things, when didn't go to the funeral, I wasn't told how he died. It was just that he died. And there were a lot, as a 10-year-old, there were a lot of, you know, leftover answers there that I couldn't get answered.
Did you find out when you were still a kid that he had taken his own life?
Yes. Yeah. I remember the specific day where I'd been told not to go into the living room, which is something you never tell a kid, because you tell them not to do something, they're going to do it. And I walked into the living room, and I saw an envelope on the table with some personal items. So what did I do? I opened the envelope, and there are actually pictures that were being prepared for the coroner in there of my grandfather who'd taken his life by suicide. His son was a police officer at the time as well, ended up having a long and decorated career in forensics. And I saw those pictures, and I kind of rationalised then, that's how it happened. But I never spoke to anyone about it.
You never told anyone?
No, in fact, as a family, we never really talked about it. Not that I can recall after his death. It was just, unfortunately, Pa died, and we kind of, you know, we have to move on.
Thinking about all that stuff that was going on in your early life, with your dad coming out, your mum with a series of gang-related or violent boyfriends, your granddad taking his own life, what kind of idea were you forming in your teenage brain about what it was to be a man?
Oh, I didn't know. I struggled with that. One, because I'd spent pretty much most of my grown-up life around women, and I didn't really know what was expected. My mother kept saying to me, you know, you're the man of the house now. And I didn't know really what the man of the house meant. So in my mind, that meant, well, I have to look after my sister. And I did, you know, she was 18 months younger than me. So I dutifully went about that process, albeit, as, you know, most siblings do, I resented it, you know.
Did looking after her mean physically? Like, was this part of where getting strong was part of what was going on here, do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so, because I started to, I guess, the personal things took second place. And as I said, we moved a lot, so I never really got to bond with people or friends in areas that I lived. I had friends at school because one thing my mother tried to do was keep us in the one school, and that helped. But often I'd live many kilometres away, so it was not like you could do what you traditionally do, and, you know, have a play date or play football or things like that. And so I sort of forewent that to focus, I guess. Not intentionally, but I guess that was what I believed I was meant to do, was to look after my sister and, you know, whatever happened in the family. I was meant to be the man.
In that environment, your life could have so easily gone into a trajectory, say, of crime or drugs. Mm-hmm. Why did the police get you instead?
Well, there's two sides to that story. The one story is my grandmother had her tea leaves read at a very at a time when I was young, and she already had two. She had one son and one son-in-law in the police, and she was told that she'd have three. So she indoctrinated me from an early age that I'd become a police officer because that's what a tea leaf said. But I guess I started to learn early on what was right and what was wrong. And I'd made a couple of hiccups. I'd got picked up for shoplifting once, which was just a thing. There was a crowd that I'd fallen into, and they were like, you know, let's do this. Because I didn't have that network of friends, I thought this is a way that I can embellish myself. And of course, now with time, I knew that they were never going to charge me, but they frightened the life out of me, brought me down, you know, told me all the things that were going to happen. And I was eternally grateful for that. And I think from that day on, I never jaywalked. And I took that as a get out of jail card that because I was heading down that pathway, you know, with some people that probably weren't the nicest people in the world. I know many others don't have that opportunity, but I made a decision there and then that I wouldn't do that. And then as I was at school, you know, I was fortunate enough to be involved in leadership with prefects and cadets and things like that. And I enjoyed that and I liked that idea that, you can lead others, but more so the helpful side, being able to help people, and that's what attracted me to policing.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
Grant, when you decided that you were going to join the police, why was it the AFP and not the New South Wales Police Force that got your application?
I applied for a multiple of them. Both my uncles were in the New South Wales Police. Back in the, the early 80s, initially you didn't need a high school certificate. The year I was in high school, you needed a high school certificate. And then after that, you needed to have certain grades, etc., which I met. And so I put out a number of applications and went through the various gateways, if you like, for both New South Wales and the AFP. I think I also applied for Northern Territory Police. The consistent theme that came back to me then was that I was overweight, both in New South Wales and the AFP. And they said, no, there's a weight-to-height ratio, and you've got to hit that weight-to-height ratio. So I sort of struggled. I went and did other things for a couple of years, and then eventually I'd become so flabbergasted. I rang the AFP, the recruiting officer that I've been dealing with, and I told him I'd lost the weight. He said, oh, that's great. Congratulations. I need you to come to Sydney and see the doctor. So I thought, I've got myself into a wicked problem here. How do I get out of this? So I think I had to lose somewhere in vicinity of about 16 kilograms. I essentially starved myself.
When you were still fairly fresh in the AFP, Grant, you were assigned to guard a hotel room in Gosford. What was going on there?
That was when the M3 was being developed and the bridge, the big bridge on the M3 just south of Gosford was being opened. So I was looking after the room that Bob Hawke had as he was the Prime Minister at the time.
What happened?
Well, no one told me that there was a wedding on at the hotel at the same time. And sort of around about 8 p.m. at night, the wedding party started to all enjoy life a little bit too much and jumped in the pool, and they were pretty much naked, skinny dipping. And I sort of panicked. I thought, this is not good. So I went down and said to these people, look, I need you to get out of the pool. Prime Minister's on his way back. And they're like, Hawkey's coming back. And I went, yeah. And they're all, yeah, Hawkey's, let's have a beer with Hawkey. And I'd fueled their environment. And as much as I pleaded for them to get out of the pool, they wouldn't get out. And I thought, oh, no, this was a good career for the short period that I was in it. And
all I had to do
doomed.
Was guard a hotel room.
I know. I just got, one thing they told me to do, one thing. And then, so I got a call on the radio saying the Prime Minister's back, and I thought, wow, okay. I didn't tell them. I thought I still had some time to get these people out, and of course they didn't move. So the PM came back, and as these people did, they were yelling, Hawkey, Hawkey, and he
and
turned.
And these guys were all nude in the pool.
Yeah, they were in the pool. Yes, they were. I'd asked them to put clothes on, and they didn't. He went over, and he was very gracious, and I thought, please don't pull him in. His security detail were livid that, that I allowed that to happen. But he did what he traditionally did and spoke to them and was all very good. And he said, well, enjoy the night, you know, keep it down. I've got to sleep. I've got to get an early start in the morning, and went up to his room and thanked me and closed the door.
Well, if it was going to happen with any Prime Minister, it's probably good that it happened with Bob Hawke.
I absolutely agree, yes.
Very different sorts of police work as your career progressed, Grant. You helped establish a cybercrime unit to fight child exploitation. How brutal was that work?
It's probably the toughest work that police can ever do, because you're dealing with children, you're dealing with little people who are vulnerable, who are trusting of adults, who haven't had the excesses or the thoughts in their mind about, put in their mind about how bad things are. And when you do that kind of work, you do so willingly knowing that, you know, there's more than an even chance, there's probably a 100% chance that in some way, shape or form, you'll be damaged by what you're doing or what you're seeing.
Was that acknowledged by your superiors at the time? Like, was there an understanding of the toll being exposed to those images and those crimes day after day would have on people?
No. When I first went into this environment back in the early 2000s when I returned from Los Angeles, at the time, we didn't have any federal legislation, so there were no Commonwealth laws that allowed us to physically go and arrest people and put them before the court. So what essentially we were doing is we were a triaging group of people, and there are only four of us. And what would happen is we would receive daily all the images, all the videos where, you know, it had either been determined or not determined whether there were potentially a child at risk in Australia. So we'd have to go through those, work out which ones were the most serious, and then we'd send them across to ACMA, the Media and Communications Authority, because they had the legislation to certify it as child exploitation material.
Right, so you couldn't even go after the perpetrators yourself?
No. That's right. So when we got that material back, when they'd classify it and we got it back, then we'd look at either identifying where it was or which jurisdiction in Australia, and we would send that out to the relevant state police to be able to investigate. Or if it were in the ACT, we could send it to our own people over in the ACT.
It must have been impossible to leave work behind when you left it for the day. Those images wouldn't have been something you could have just left in a box.
No, you can't. I mean, it's like a branding iron. It burns into your brain. And once you've seen them, you can't unsee them. It's like with any sort of traumatic event. It doesn't matter what you do. You can't not, you know, expunge that from your mind.
You did manage to have success in stopping instances of child exploitation. Tell me how a kookaburra helped you identify one abuser.
We'd received a referral. I mean, in today's environment, we get about 18,000 referrals a year just from one entity of child exploitation. But this one, it had been referred to us from a Baltic nation through what was the Europol area there. And one of the police officers there had been to Australia. And when they turned the volume up, they heard a kookaburra. So they said, this is in Australia.
So, it was an image from Australia that had ended
up it was a video.
In Eastern Europe.
Yeah, it was a video. So we received the referral. And all as we knew that it was Australian, you couldn't really hear the accents deliberately, but you could hear in the background a kookaburra. They had some very competent people in the team, and what we did is we went to ANU to see if we could get an idea through the bush in the background, the type of trees and where it would be, and they narrowed it down to a corner in Australia for us. So we worked out roughly where we thought it would be, somewhere between New South Wales and Victoria, but we wanted to make sure that we captured the whole of Australia. So we agreed with all the state and territory police to do a concerted media effort to try and identify, because it looked like the footage was reasonably concurrent at that time. We didn't know if it was old or if there was a child, but essentially what it was is that there was a child there and there was an elderly man in the bush.
So you'd be desperate to stop this.
Yes.
And you put out a media release saying that we have a sense it's in this part of the country. What happened after the media made that announcement about what you knew so far?
Yeah, well, some people came forward into the New South Wales police and were able to identify who the individuals were. And it turned out that the elderly man, when I say elderly man, in his 50s, 60s, he was the grandfather of the child. And he was a former police officer in another part of Australia, but he was also a medic when he was in the army. He'd actually done the same to the child's mother and her brother, and it was a whole family secret. And so he would take the child out of school, and the mother would agree to it, and he would take the child into the bush.
It's such awful, disturbing stuff to hear, but this is something you had to spend your working day with day in, day out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long were you in that unit for, Grant?
On and off for about 3 years, and then I came back to that in 2010 when I took over what is now the AFP cybercrime area, which had the child exploitation component. Shortly after I finished there, the government provided funds and legislation to allow us to be able to investigate that, as well as the travelling sex offender. So the AFP has the legislation and the authority to investigate and prosecute those who travel overseas to exploit children, where the local jurisdiction doesn't want or is unable to do that. And we've done that quite successfully.
What sort of relationship did you have with your colleagues in that work environment?
Yeah, it was hard. We didn't have any psychological support back in those days. And it wasn't like it is now where you volunteered to do it. It was just that it was a job that needed to be done. And unfortunately, I came into that unit post 9/11, where the AFP's resources were all diverted to counter-terrorism. So we were a small group of four. At the biggest, about six. But most of the people that were in there weren't sworn police officers, so they joined the police to do enabling service work or intelligence work and came into that area. They were very committed, they were very passionate, and they did a great job. But we were all impacted. One, unfortunately, died by suicide. I mean, I was impacted myself, and others were impacted through self-medicating and other ways. It's a brutal type of environment to work in, and it's probably more prevalent than people realise.
You did volunteer then later in your career to go to Afghanistan.
Yes.
Why did you put your hand up for that?
I liked that type of work, and it was a unique role that I was going into. So,
what was it? What was the AFP doing over there?
Well, we'd been there for about 8 years. The whole Afghanistan story with the AFP isn't widely well known. We'd been over there in a number of different iterations. We started off with a small group of four doing counter-narcotics work because of the fact that majority of the world's heroin comes out of that area. We morphed when the international forces were at their highest to be able to help reconstitute the Afghan National Police. So at its highest, we had about 30 AFP there. But through my predecessor's good work, we identified an opportunity to work with the International Police Coordination Board of Afghanistan to try and harness all the different elements that were there in a unity of effort to help build the Afghan police. Because it was the police at the time, and what's not widely known is that when President Karzai was president, he didn't want to acknowledge the Taliban or those groups. So he determined that it wasn't a war, that he determined that they were organised crime figures. So the police had the mandate to do the work on that, but they were suffering immense casualties because a lot of them were illiterate, they weren't well trained, corruption was rife because they weren't being paid. So we were trying to help harness to build the institution, and that was appealing to me. I had a background in anthropology, so I researched and understood the cultural nuances there, and I could see that there was something that could be done that was really worthwhile to do that.
It didn't feel like an impossible task, because the way you just describe it, it sounds like a big mountain to climb.
Yeah, I think in the cold, hard light of day, yes. But when you see that opportunity and not, you know, having been exposed to it, I thought it wouldn't be as difficult as it was. I certainly realise now that was a difficult road to travel, but we picked what we needed to do to try and get some wins. And what we looked at doing was working more on the institution of policing, so not training the police. Because what was happening over there, had so many nations there, police had come in and trained them in their own system, so they'd get fatigued. You know, this week we're doing the German system, next week it's the Australian system, the week after it's the European. So we wanted to try and just strengthen the institution to try and make sure that that had the capability to withhold any of the stresses, and to try and get the right people in there that then would allow for all those things that we take for granted the police in Afghanistan could get to do. You know, at least learn to read and write, at least be able to get paid every week and not have to hold people to ransom to get money, which breeds that corruption. It's really
self-perpetuating,
yeah. Yes.
Well, how would you describe your mental state when you were working in that environment and responsible, I guess, for all those officers under you, as well as the Afghans you were working with?
Yeah. I'd started to have some physical impediments that were occurring to me. I mean, I'd spent 2 years in East Timor and contracted some diseases and dengue fever and things like that. So I probably wasn't at my best, but I just thought it was a combination of getting old, plus, you know, you're getting sick and things like that. My main focus, and I would say this to everyone that came in and everyone who worked for me, because not only did I have the Australians, I also had police from the US, the UK, France, Germany, Croatia under me. And I would say to them, there's nothing in this place that is more important than your own physical safety. And I was very, very stringent on that. So I had the ability each and every day to work out whether we were moving or not. The Australian government believe that we were working behind the line, if you like, in the green zone. But to do what we needed to do, in particularly in Kabul, we needed to be out every day. So I had two teams of security, and I went everywhere in a ballistic vest, as did most of those folks that were working for me, to be able to get around to where we needed to go. So it was important to make sure that when I said it was okay to travel, that it was. A lot of it was... finger in the air, because we didn't have the intelligence streams that the military had and others had, and we would rely on information thinking, well, okay, it's right to go or it's not.
It's a huge responsibility. How long did you spend in Afghanistan?
I was there overall a year, but we would have periods where we would go in and then come out, but it was almost 12 months.
How was it to come back to work with the AFP in Australia after that?
It was difficult, because whilst I was in Afghanistan, I was dealing with the highest of diplomats, briefing, you know, four-star generals and people from the United Nations and the European Mission and things. You're operating at a really high level, and then you come back, and you come back into the organisation where, you know, you fit nicely in that structure. So all those sort of that autonomy that you have and the ability to do things, it becomes quite diminished. So, you know, and when I came back, I come back from such a heightened state back to normality without any time to decompress. And these are all things I know now, of course. At the time, I didn't. You never sort of really had time to sort of reconfigure and sort of defrag your brain, if you like.
Well, you're still in that kind of hypervigilant state even when you're back in safe old Brisbane.
Yeah, I was. I tell the story where I'd gone down to do some training at the local high school, and I'd only been home a couple of weeks, and I hadn't even warmed up yet, and I heard rapid fire, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Which automatically put me in the headspace back in Afghanistan. And I did what I was trained to do. I hit the deck to minimise, and my heart rate went through the roof. But I couldn't rationalise. I remember my saying, you know, no, you're in Australia. This is not right. What's going on? And I took cover and looked, and I could see kids running around in the high school with guns. And then I realised after a few minutes that it was a paintball holiday camp. But I reacted to that. I was told later on by psychologists that that was normal. That's just hypervigilance, and it'd eventually go away, but it didn't.
What were things like at home, Gran? How were things with your wife and your daughter, your young daughter?
Well, yeah, I thought everything was fine. I thought I was clearly living in a false statehood, I know now. I wasn't consciously aware of the behaviours that I was doing, but I'd become very distant. I sort of removed myself from society.
What would you do when you got home from work?
I'd sit on the couch and watch TV.
What sort of stuff?
I was besotted with a program called Afghanistan Bomb.
Afghanistan Bomb?
It was the bomb squad that would go around and neutralise all the bombs and things like that. So I struggled with my clarity of thought. And then when I realised after doing my medicals that I contracted yet some other nasty diseases, I started to have problems with physical problems, with massive bouts of inflammation, with stomach problems, with a whole raft of things. At home, it was tough for my wife because it's called presenteeism. I was there, but I wasn't. But I didn't consciously know that. By that stage, I was self-medicating and relying on alcohol, which is something that I'd never done because of the history of my family. But that was the only way that I could sleep and try and turn my mind off.
What were your dreams like?
I've been fortunate where I haven't recalled a lot of the dreams. I know my wife has videotaped me, and my bodily reactions have been quite nasty. But the ones that I did recall were all about either me dying or the inability to save others, in particular children. I would feel like I was either shot in the neck or had my neck slashed and things like that. And sleep was almost non-existent. Well, proper sleep was non-existent. But I'd gotten to the stage where my wife couldn't even leave me at home with my daughter because, well, she told me one day she came home and she was out on the street. I was supposed to be looking after her. So it was a difficult time. You know, I just thought I wasn't physically well. I'd been sent to a number of different specialists who were all treating me in their own specialist way.
And you thought it was a physical thing?
And I kept thinking it was a physical thing, but I kept saying to them, there's something causing all this because this is not me. This is not meant to happen. I mean, I couldn't pick my daughter up. I couldn't even hold a coffee cup because of the pain that I was suffering all through my body, the inflammation, the headaches, the brain fog. I remember trying to do some work around the house and my wife stopped me. She goes, I don't want you touching any power tools because you're going to hurt yourself.
Did any of the doctors you were seeing suggest that maybe you had PTSD?
None of the specialists did. It wasn't until, in frustration, I went to my GP after I'd been seeing all these specialists, and I said to him, you know, I'm not well. There's something that's causing all these physical manifestations. And my doctor's a lovely, elderly, skinny Scotsman, you know, and he touched me on the arm and he said, well, I'm glad you've said that. He said, because for some time I thought you've had PTSD. And that was the last four letters I heard. He talking to me But I didn't hear that because once he said that, I started to think, oh, my God, no, that's not me. That only happens to army people.
Why was that such a scary diagnosis to hear?
My immediate thought was, I'll lose my job, I'll lose my security clearance, I won't be able to work. The stigma attached to it is terrible. I'll be put in some area where what we refer to as broken biscuits go. Everything was negative. It was horrible. Eventually, you know, he wrote me a script and he said, look, these are antidepressants. They're going to help you. It's going to stabilise your mood a little bit. It's going to help you. It won't cure you. You should take them. Come back and see me in a couple of weeks. I begrudgingly took the script. I went home and told my wife and she said, oh, wow, okay. What are you going to do? I didn't know that she'd been dealing with people behind the scenes and she'd been advised that they thought I had PTSD.
Or talking to colleagues of yours behind the scenes.
Well, not colleagues, no. Because I told her, no one needs to know about this. I don't want anyone to know. She tried to Google and find, you know, policing support networks and couldn't, but she found a group of, ironically, American wives and partners, and that's where she was getting all her advice from the US, which meant that she could only do that at night when they were awake or send emails. So she said, what are you going to do? And I said, I need to think about it, but I don't want a diagnosis of PTSD against my name. I said, that's rubbish. So I didn't sleep that night. And I agonised over it. And the next day I said to him, I'm going back to the doctors. I'm going to take the script back and get him to expunge it from my record, which is what I did. I went in and I stood over him. And I mean, I'm 6'4". He's probably 5'5" at the best. And I said, I need you to take that off my record. And here's the script back. And he talked to me about privilege and things. And I said, no, I know how that works. Delete it. And he did. I now know that he put it back in there, but I was confident with that. So I carried on for many more months thinking that I could, you know, work through all these physical manifestations. But my wife was too afraid to confront me about what was happening psychologically because she was worried about the fear. And so she was being guided by certain people and a couple of friends to try and best manage me. But of course, nothing was going to make a difference.
So what finally happened for you to be able to acknowledge that you did need help?
Well, it wasn't until many, many months later where I had actually been notified that I'd been successful for the position in Washington.
The position with the AFP.
With the AFP, yeah. As the Commander of America, as it's referred to. And I'd won that. But earlier, a good friend of mine, he was already over there in that position. And the World Police and Fire Games were on. So I was trying to keep physically fit as best I could as a way to try and deal with the symptoms that I was having. So I went over there to do the Police and Fire Games. And while we were there, it started to dawn on me that given the intensity of that position, that I might not be able to do that. And I remember sitting in the room downstairs just at night, just going through all this, saying, I can't do this. The next day, I sat under a tree. I was thinking all about the things, about why I couldn't do this and how it would impact on my family and it would impact on the job. I just started to cry. And I don't cry. You know, that masculine thing, men don't cry. Or if you do, you do it in public like I was doing. And I made the decision that, you know what, I can't keep this facade up. I've got to disclose that I've got a problem. So the next morning, I got up with David and I said, mate, we cancel that meeting. We need to go and have a coffee. And we drove out to a coffee shop in Washington under the freeway and we sat down and he's like, what's up? And I won't repeat how I said it, but I said, I'm not good. I've got a problem. And my doctor told me 8 months ago that I've got PTSD. And he was like, you? Really? Wow. You know? And I said, I can't do the job. I've witnessed what you do and I can't maintain that. I've got to get help. So long story short, you know, we mulled it over and he's such a good guy. He said, no, let's not make any rash decisions. Let's call back to Australia. He said, are you happy to talk to the boss? So I rang back and spoke to the acting deputy commissioner at the time and told him. And he said, well, I'll let the commissioner know. But he said the same. He said, don't do any rash. Let's just work through this. And then I got a call from Commissioner Colvin. He said, I hear you're not well. And I said, no. I said, look, you know, I'm pretty sure I've got PTSD. It hasn't been diagnosed, but I've been told that. And I want to let you know that with that in mind, you know, I shouldn't go to Washington. I want to let you know now. So you've got time to put someone else in. He said, well, hang on a minute. He said, just let me ask you this. He said, what are your intentions? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, are you going to see a doctor? And I said, yeah, I've already made a booking to see my doctor when I get back. He said, are you going to look at medication? I said, yes, he's going to put me on medication. I'm going to start that. And he said, what about your treatment? He said, we're going to write a treatment plan. I've got a psychologist sorted. And he said, and if you were to go to Washington, would you continue that? And I said, absolutely. And he said, well, what's the problem? And I couldn't respond to that. And I said, well, yeah, it's PTSD. He goes, I don't have an issue with that. He said, the fact that you've acknowledged it, you're willing to undertake treatment, you're willing to take medication, you're willing to do everything right. He said, I'd much rather have someone in that frame of mind than send someone over who I didn't know, who hadn't declared it, and then we have all sorts of problems to deal with. He said, we don't do this stuff very well. That was an epiphany to me. That's not the response that I expected. So I essentially, as I tended to do, go from 0 to 100. I didn't sleep on the flight back to Australia. I wrote a 16-page letter to the psychologist who I was going to see to try and truncate the process. Went back home, got the medication, started the medication, and then it's been a process ever since then. That was back in early 2015.
And how are things with you now?
Much better, but it's still a day in, day out. I have bad days, and I understand and I know from the treatment that I've done that that happens. There are some folk out there that say that you can cure PTSD. I don't think you can. I think it lives with you. You can't unburn what's in your brain, but you can get back to a relative normal life, depending, first of all, if you own it. And I'm a big proponent in owning it, irrespective of what other elements have caused you to be where you are. You have to, as a person, own it, because your body is the only thing that you have control over in life. I took a loan out to undertake my treatment because it was quite expensive. I did that in consultation with my family because I thought, I'm not going to go through life living the way that I am. So you've got to do that, but also you've got to face the realism that you'll have bad periods, you'll have bad days, and now I know to acknowledge that. My wife's far more attuned to identifying that than I am, and she'll say to me, "You were right today." And I go, "No, I'm fine." She goes, "I don't think you are. I think you're in for a bout." And sure enough, within 24 hours.
What does she notice, do you think, when she says that?
My behaviour, my speech. I start to get a little bit, there's a fog in terms of the inability to make decisions, but a little bit erratic in my thinking. It's almost, it's really hard to describe. It's not bipolar, but it's like having that rush of adrenaline where everything, you know, you're functioning at 100 mile an hour, you're doing everything great, and then within 48 hours, you're hitting the bottom. And that's when you start to get some bad habits creep in, all the desire to go back to those habits because that's all you know. So we try and control that now, and I'm far more adept at going, you know what, I'm out. So the last one I had, I think I slept 2 days, probably 14 and 17 hours, which is highly unusual for me to do that. But it's almost like you just need to go dark. I don't take phone calls. I don't take text messages. I communicate with my wife more because I wasn't doing that before. And, you know, she's almost like my litmus test now.
The strength to notice that and to act on it, how does it compare to the strength that is required to pull a steam engine or lift those manhood stones?
They're the same, but they're not. The strength to do something physical, you know exactly what it is that you have to do. You have a choice. You can do it or you choose not to. And within that choice, there's different ways of doing it, but you're all in control of that. The strength of having a mental health problem is that you don't choose that. It happens to you. And you don't necessarily choose how it affects you. There's all these variables. And I had to learn to understand how those variables impacted on me. I still don't have it 100% because there are still things that happen or come back, but I'm far more attuned now at understanding. So the strength to push through something that you really have no control over is a very different strength than it is to say to move potentially inanimate object. This thing never leaves you.
It sounds like you've got both kinds of strength though.
I hope so. I want to be able to show people that it's okay not to be okay. If you own it and the more you talk about it, it also diminishes that stigma.
Thank you so much for sharing your story on Conversations.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
My guest today was Grant Edwards, and Grant's memoir is The Strong Man. And if this conversation has left you wanting to talk to someone, remember Lifeline are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 13, 11, 14. Those details on our website too. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.